Hello, this is David Rovics, and you are listening to the Liberated Airwaves of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's show, host Keith Brownell talks with Sharon Snyder, who worked as a judicial administrative assistant for 30 years until she was fired for helping free an innocent man. Then in the second half of our show, Robin Martinez talks with Heidi Boghossian about her book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Stay with us for the whole hour. We will be presenting a calendar of events in the middle of the show, and the 420 Drug War News has moved to after our goodbyes. Up next is Keith and Sharon Snyder.
The scientific discovery of DNA has shattered the myth that the American judicial system does not put innocent people in jail. Every day we are finding more and more people being released from prison who were there because they were wrongfully convicted. The most recent example of this is the case of Mr. Robert Nelson, who spent 29 years in the Missouri Department of Corrections for a crime he did not commit. He was eventually exonerated through the help of Ms. Sharon Snyder, a clerk at the Jackson County Circuit Court. Ms. Snyder supplied Robert Nelson's sister, Ms. C. Donald, with a document Robert needed to obtain a DNA test and ultimately prove his innocence. Unfortunately, there was a price that had to be paid. And perhaps you've heard the expression, no good deed should go unpunished. Well, despite her 34 years of outstanding service to the Jackson County Circuit Court, Ms. Snyder, for her good deed, was fired from her job for merely providing Robert's sister with a document that was a matter of public record, which she was required to do by law. And so on today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, Ms. Snyder is here to tell us her story.
Good morning, Ms. Snyder, and thank you for being on our show. The first question I'd like to ask you is, where are you from and how long have you lived in Kansas City, Missouri?
Well, I'm basically from Springfield, Missouri, but I moved up here when I was young and chose not to live in that town. So actually, Kansas City is my hometown.
How long were you employed as a clerk of the Jackson County Court?
34 and a half years. I started working there January the 11th, 1979.
How many different judges did you serve under?
Well, for a time, before I went to Division III, I was an alternate clerk, so I worked wherever I was needed and probably worked with every judge they had in the circuit court and some of the associate judges. And then when I went to Division III, I went under Judge Tom Clark, and when he retired, when he turned 70, then Judge Byrne took the bench in, I believe it was September of 2008.
Okay. Now, have you ever received any reprimands or other disciplinary action for many of the judges prior to the time you were fired for the incident involving Robert Nelson?
Oh, no. I always did my work with diligence, and I loved my job.
How did you become acquainted with Robert Nelson?
I didn't meet Robert Nelson until 2 weeks after he was released from custody. I knew of him because of his sister and because of the motions that were being filed. I just knew his name.
Where did you meet his sister, and how long have you known her?
Well, after the first motion for DNA testing was denied, his sister came to the division to try to find the transcript, and the court reporter wasn't there that day, and I said, well, I can help you. So I gave her my name and my number and told her to call me back in about a week and so I could order the transcript from archives. So she told me some about the case, and I commiserated with her that the motion was denied, and I believe I suggested that the judge was new to the bench and he hadn't done that much criminal, and maybe her brother should refile that motion. And then, of course, she called me about a week later, and I told her that they couldn't find a transcript on that particular case, and we...
What was the reason for them not being able to find a transcript? Did it not exist, or they just got misplaced, or what?
We are not sure, but the notes, the court administrator of maybe 6 months to a year before had all the notes destroyed from a certain time frame because storing them in the archives or in the caves where they have all those old things was costly for the court. And so we could never find a transcript, although there was another case that Robert was involved in that did have a transcript. So possibly his attorney hadn't requested one.
Now, could you tell us what are your specific duties as a clerk? What do they involve?
Well, they change from judge to judge. I used to run the division, so to speak. I did all the scheduling and processed any orders that the judge might sign and kind of was the liaison between the attorneys and the court. But when Judge Byrne came on, he wanted those duties to go to his law clerk because she was an attorney. And so I just primarily processed orders.
And what was Mr. Nelson in prison for?
Well, he was in prison for a robbery that he and his brother had committed where they were playing dice on the corner and somebody won their money and so they took it back. And he did do that. He got 15 years for that. Then they accused him of another robbery where three men went into a house and was robbing this woman, and she had a 14-year-old daughter. He states that he did not do that, although he got 10 years and 3 years consecutive and for robbery and armed criminal action. And then the last one was when he got exonerated on, which was sodomy, rape, and robbery. And I believe he got 70 years on that. So, and all of these sentences were consecutive, which he would have been in there maybe 90 years or something.
Do you have any knowledge of who the initial prosecutor was in the prosecution of Mr. Nelson's case?
John O'Connor, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what kind of person was he? Is he somebody that tries to do what a prosecutor is supposed to do? Or is he someone that just goes after people for just to try to make a name and a reputation for himself?
Well, John is now a defense attorney, and he's had some pretty big cases. However, it was told to me by C, the sister, that he told Robert's parents at the time of the trial, your son probably didn't do it, but he says, I have to do my job. And I think that's a lot of times prosecutors feel that. They're very zealous on if somebody's been charged, they got to go after them with everything they've got. You know, I've seen cases where the prosecutor probably knew the person wasn't guilty, but they had to go after him because that was...
During the time that you were working in the courts, did you have the occasion to see any other cases that came through where people were wrongfully convicted and were later exonerated?
No, I really didn't. Like I say, the only DNA testing that we had was Robert's case and this other case, and I don't know, I think the other case is still pending.
Do you know the process through which people have to go through to obtain a DNA testing? Is it a lengthy process or?
Well, the Kansas City Crime Lab, as I understand it, does most of the DNA testing on Robert's case because he had filed his first motion in 2009, and it was like 2013 by the time things started rolling on the DNA testing. The Innocence Project wanted to speed things up because two hairs and the semen on a robe came back that it wasn't Robert, but the prosecutor had 25 more hairs. And he wanted those tested also.
All 25?
Well, yeah. I don't think they ended up testing all 25 because the hair follicle has to be on the hair to get a really good testing. So the Innocence Project paid a big sum of money to have a private lab test those other hairs to get it expedited. So
there was an article in the Kansas City Star said that they paid about $40,000 to expedite
$40,000, yes.
And I'm wondering if that means that everybody that wants a DNA test has to have $40,000 at their disposal to obtain the test.
No, that was just to get it expedited to a private lab. Because Judge Byrne didn't grant the first motion, it took 4 years for this all to go through. So he spent an extra 4 years he wouldn't have had to spend.
And after he granted the motion, it could have taken even longer, right?
Right.
So he's been exonerated on the rape charges.
Right, the rape and sodomy case, yes. But it says in the probable cause on the other robbery charge, the second robbery charge, that they were similar. They were all in a similar area. And so there was a crime spree going on at that time out in South Kansas City.
Now, what is this probable cause motion that you're speaking of? What does it entail?
Well, probable cause tells what happened and why the prosecutors are filing the charges and what happened at the crime.
So when his sister came to speak with you about obtaining these records, you were just basically trying to provide her with some assistance in obtaining the records that she was already in pursuit of.
Right.
I'm assuming that at that time you didn't think that you were offering her any legal advice or anything.
Oh, no.
You didn't know that it would lead to this.
No, I was just trying to get her the transcript and everything like that. And she was telling me her problems, and I felt sorry for her. I mean, you know, she was between a rock and a hard place. I was trying to, you know.
How would you describe yourself as a person as far as being able to help people? Or are you somebody that normally reaches out and tries to go the extra mile? Or do you just basically direct people to information or whatever?
Well, I like to be helpful. You know, I like to make people's life, help them get to their goal. I worked in child support and helped many women help get their child support, and I'm very zealous about helping people, and that's just my personality. My father was a minister, and I imagine I learned that from an early child to help people.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brown Eel, and today on Jaws of Justice Radio, I am talking with Ms. Sharon Snyder, a former clerk of the Jackson County Circuit Court, who was fired from her job because she helped Robert Nelson, a wrongfully convicted person, obtain his freedom.
Now, they accused you of some type of ethics violation, right?
Right.
Considering the outcome of this case, it looks very much like if you had not offered the assistance that you offered to his sisters for helping her acquire the documentation, that this man would have never gotten out of prison. And him being innocent of the charge, that meant that other people who actually committed the crime would have gone unpunished.
If Robert Nelson's sister had followed all of the processes and the procedures,
she would have ended up with the paperwork anyway. All you simply did is gave her a shortcut. What was the harm in that, even if there was an ethics violation? It seemed to me it could have been easily overlooked.
Well, when Judge Byrne denied the second motion, she was at her wit's end. She didn't know where to go with it. She was worried about her brother. He was feeling helpless, and he was depressed because they kept on denying it when all he wanted to do was have his blood tested to prove his innocence. And, of course, in my way of thinking, anybody that would file a motion for DNA testing must know the answer to it. For the simple fact, it's either going to prove he's guilty or he's not guilty.
Exactly.
And so we've got them both ways. And so when she came to me, she said, "What should I do now?" I said, "I don't know. I was just as upset because I really felt strongly she's a really nice person." So it just dawned on me. It was a last minute decision.
Right.
Because I thought, well, you know, we did have another DNA motion because we don't normally have that. In fact, these are the only two that I've ever seen in my years in that division. And I said, we have another one that the judge granted. Of course, the Innocence Project had prepared that motion. And the file was over in my file cabinet. Now, I could have said, go over to criminal records in another building and tell them you want the motion that Pete Wright filed for DNA testing. They would have looked up Pete Wright's case number, realized that I had the file. They would have called me and said, I need that file. I would have put it in the routine place where they come and pick up the files. It would have taken another week, but she could have gotten that motion. All I did was jumpstart it. I prepared it. It was a public record.
And you eliminated some other obstacles and hoops she had to jump through to go get it.
Right. It had already been 2 years by this time, or longer. And so I said, look, I'm going to give you this motion. You know, you give it to your brother. I don't know what's in the motion. I had no idea what the difference was. I didn't have the time to look at his motion and see what he was putting in it and the other motion. So I made a copy of the motion, and I put black marks over the case number and the names and tried to cover up certain things that they didn't need to see, and gave it to her.
I wanted to show you something here. I have a case, St. Anthony's Medical Center versus HSH, and it's from the Missouri Court of Appeals, Eastern District Division. I have something I would like you to read from this case. It's on page 3.
A petition must be read from its four corners, and a court must give to the language its plain and ordinary meaning and such interpretation as fairly appears to have been intended by the pleader. Gover versus Cleveland, 299 Southwest 2nd, 239,242, Missouri App, 1957.
Okay, so essentially what they're doing is they're quoting from another case that's been in existence since 1957 and
right.
saying that this law is still being upheld.
Right.
What does this language mean to you?
It says that if a pro se person that doesn't know the law asks for something, you should take it for what it really is.
If the judge understands what the person
right.
is asking for.
Right.
Okay, now what exactly was the problem with Judge Burns? What was his issue with the motion that was filed by Robert Nelson?
Robert used the wrong statute.
He used the wrong statute.
Everything that was in there was probably okay, but he didn't use the correct statute for what he was asking for.
But it was easily understood what he was seeking.
Right. Just the motion for DNA testing should have...
Even if he hadn't cited the statute.
Right.
According to this case.
Right.
Which is plain language enough for anybody to be able to easily understand.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, do you feel that you may have been possibly fired for personal reasons, or that the judge had his reasons for firing you were simply what he stated they were, but he found that there was an ethical violation because he interpreted your actions as giving legal advice?
Judge Byrne fired me, but also Jeff Eisenbeiss, who was a court administrator, mm-hmm. and a military man that probably decided he better didn't follow the rules. And I think the two of them were in this together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that perhaps, well, I won't say my age, but I think it was personal too. But Jeff Eisenbeiss, he's the new court administrator, and he came in to clean up the place, and mm-hmm. Judge Byrne was maybe embarrassed that his clerk had gone above and beyond with...
Well, do you feel like it's possible that the whole judicial system in this county was embarrassed because here you had an innocent man that was in prison, and it seemed like they were more concerned with trying to keep him from proving his innocence? I'm saying the fact that he filed two motions that were where it was readily apparent what he was seeking. The law says if you understand what the person filing the motion, what he's actually seeking, that you have to read that into the motion and construe it as such. And here we have this case where he denied these motions on technicality. It seemed like he was making this man run obstacle courses to try to get out of acknowledging the fact that he possibly might have been innocent, or that he must have felt that he was innocent. Now, I'm reading here where it says, according to the Innocence Project, eyewitness identification has been involved in 75% of the cases where DNA testing has later exonerated defendants. That's embarrassing to
yes.
this judicial system. And understandably, they want to fight or try to maintain their appearance that there's some type of credibility in the system. And these type of results are beginning to show, and they're beginning to make everybody aware that the judicial system is seriously flawed. So do you think it's a possibility that they may have been trying to hide their embarrassment? I'm saying because every time one of these cases come along, I mean, it explodes in the media, and it makes people stop and take a second look. And here's a man here who's already denied the motion twice. To me, that makes him look bad.
Yes.
So do you think that might have also played a factor in you being fired?
Yes. Yes, I think it was an embarrassment to him. And they decided that I had made them look bad by helping this man get out, although the two people that did commit the crime were caught, which is they should be very happy about. I mean, they went to great lengths to prove I was wrong mm-hmm. by getting the telephone records from the Department of Corrections between Robert Nelson and his sister, C. Donnell, mm-hmm. and listening to them talk about how good I'd been to them mm-hmm. by...
It seems to me like they expended more energy trying to investigate the phone records of Mr. Nelson and his sister and trying to find evidence to dig up against you than they did trying to find the people who actually committed the crime.
That's right.
the information that I received says that the other person who was involved in this crime was never arrested until 1992, when he was convicted of another crime that I think it involved a murder or something like that. I mean, if they had took all this time to investigate this matter properly in the first place, then an innocent person would not have possibly lost their life, and other people would not have been victimized by a crime that was committed later by a man who was already supposed to be in prison for what Mr. Nelson was accused of. So I think that probably indicates that that was another embarrassing piece of information that was that resulted in you helping Mr. Nelson be exonerated. Now, what I want to ask you is, has this situation about you being fired, how has it impacted your life?
Well, financially, yes, it has. I mean, I had my retirement all planned out and how I could financially do it. And, of course, 9 months is a long time for me to gather the funds I needed to retire.
So you
God know. Has been good to me, and I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. At first, I didn't think I was going to get my pension. I had several people tell me, you probably won't get your pension, and I was just devastated, you know.
So you would have been left with no means of support?
No means of support, you know, except for my Social Security, which... Yeah, and it's hurtful to be in a job for 34 and a half years where you did everything you could to be a good employee. When I had carpal tunnel surgery, I took off one day and I came back in because I didn't want to take off, you know. I hated to take off for doctor appointments that I really needed to. So I was a good employee. It meant something to me.
So you won't receive your retirement until another 9 months from now, is that right?
No, I'm receiving it now.
Oh, okay.
It's just not as much as it would have been for another 9 months, and I wasn't able to get all the bills paid off that I had worked out a schedule.
So whatever you're getting now, that's what you'll be getting for the rest of
The rest of my life, yes.
So how much did they reduce your retirement to?
Well, it was probably about $100 a month, I would say. I don't have those figures, but it was less. And, of course, the money I would have made between July, when I was let go, and March was sizable.
If you wanted to go back and work as a clerk, is it possible that another judge could hire you?
That's a good old boys club up there. Although I think there are some judges that still like me as a person, they wouldn't.
They have to fall in line with the troops.
Right, they have to fall in line with the troops. And I wouldn't put anybody in that position. I think they know that I'm a good clerk and that I am.
Well, are you seeking any other type of employment?
Well, no, I've been too tired going around to interviews and different things. And one reason I didn't want to retire so soon is I have great-grandchildren that live next door to me, and they're there all the time. And I said, I don't want to spend the day with them because I already spend the night with them. But now I'm spending day and night with them. So.
Well, you were gracious enough to provide me with a copy of this motion that Mr. Nelson filed. And I'm not exactly certain how I'm going to be able to do this, but I do intend to take this motion and make it available through the Internet or for people who want to have copies of it so no one else will have to go through what you went through and what Mr. Nelson went through again. That motion will be available somewhere on the Internet, and I can't say exactly where on the station because, you know, we're not allowed to do certain things as far as advertising is concerned. But we will be getting information out through the public through some means or another to let people know where they can locate this motion if they have relatives in prison that need access to this type of information, so it won't be hoarded by the courts any longer. And I do appreciate you stopping by and doing the interview. Everybody who's in prison right now or people who are facing charges for crimes that they didn't commit, everyone is indebted to you, not just Mr. Nelson. I think you've done a tremendous service to the people here in this county, the people in this state, and to humanity in general, and I think other people need to follow your example.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. I am glad Mr. Nelson is out. I wish him the best of luck, and at least he didn't die in prison, which he was pretty sure he was going to. And if I did anything to help that, be it give a motion that was a public record to his sister, so be it.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Everything was fine in Gina before they came along. Michigan and Harlem and all them brown towns. The rising tide lifts all boats. David Duke got all our votes. Everything is fine in Gina. There ain't a single thing that a white can do that a black can't do in Gina, too, except live in a nice house on a nice street. Accumulated wealth over generations, you can't call that a racist nation. Everything's fine in Gina. We don't have a race problem here. It's not about color. It's about crime and fear. Black kids want to sit on a white tree. Sounds to me like a crime spree. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I can end your life with a stroke of a pen. Everything is fine, Gina. Don't tell me you don't do the same, because your New York Bell had a different name. Michael's in jail, Sean.
This is the Jaws of Justice radio calendar for October 14th. The next Homelessness Task Force meeting will be Friday, October 25th from 9 to 11 a.m. at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. The guest will be Ian Dijon, a national consultant on homelessness system change, to start a conversation about the Housing First philosophy and developing a system that helps connect homeless to the organization that can best meet their needs for services and resources. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found at the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. We thank everyone that contributed to the KKFI on-air pledge drive and remind you that you can still contribute on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. We invite you to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder as Michael Ratner investigates the legality of the U.S. Special Forces raid in Libya that captured a suspected al-Qaeda leader. And Phyllis Bennis is in to talk about the United States, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, and Israel. Up next, Robin Martinez talks with Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild, about her new book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance.
This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the law firm Martinez, Madrigal & Machacow, and a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. You're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. This morning on Jaws of Justice, we're speaking with Heidi Boghossian. Heidi is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, and she's joining us via telephone from New York City. We're having Heidi on this morning because she authored a very important new book that I think is really worth your effort to read. The title of the book is called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Welcome to Jaws of Justice, Heidi.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about what prompted you to write this book.
Well, for the past 14 years since I've been with the National Lawyers Guild, I've been firsthand involved in witnessing police treatment of protesters across the country. We do what's called mass defense and have legal observers at mass assemblies to look out for police overreaching. So I've been interested in how often agent provocateur infiltrate groups and how, in our opinion, protesters really are given a bad rap in terms of how they're depicted in the media. So I started by thinking that I'd be writing a book largely about spying on activists. But then as I started to write, I realized, well, lawyers have been spied on historically, including the National Lawyers Guild, and members of the press had been spied on in several high-profile cases, and I started to realize, well, children, when they first learn how to type on a keyboard and use the computer and the internet, are befriended by corporate advertisers trying to get their personal information. So it really expanded into different groups of people who were spied on, and then ultimately I sort of examined the rise of technology and how pervasive surveillance is in every aspect of our lives.
That is such a tremendously broad scope of material to cover. One of the things that struck me about reading your book was the very first chapter. You talked about the rise of protest in New York City. by a group of bicyclists called Critical Mass. And I thought that was a really good sort of hook to start with, because what's it be so bad about going out and having a bunch of people ride bikes? But yet the police department, it seemed like, took an extraordinary interest in this. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I thought actually it was a striking example because, as you say, bicyclists, such a benign group of people, and we really want to promote bicycling, especially in large urban areas, for a range of reasons. But what happened was around 2003 and 2004, right before the Republican National Convention came to town in New York, we saw an enormous crackdown on what were called monthly critical mass bicycle rides, and they occur all across the country and across around the world, where bicyclists get together and celebrate, really, being in the streets, riding around. And in New York, they worked with a group called Time's Up that promoted alternatives to, you know, cars and motorized transportation. What happened was we started to see, really, anti-terrorism mechanisms being used, helicopters, a blimp with the NYPD logo and the Fuji logo flying above whenever these bicyclists would gather, police buying scooters and sending hundreds of officers out on scooters to ride with the riders. And then we found out later that the groups were heavily infiltrated, that in fact police would ride undercover through the streets, sometimes directing them in the wrong directions or to, you know, go through traffic lights. People would be arrested on really non-charges. But the effect that it had over years was to intimidate people from joining in the rides. And as we see with a lot of government spying on activists, even in the 60s during COINTELPRO, part of the result, if not the intention, is to disrupt groups that are critical of both government and corporate policy. So in New York, what was interesting is that recently it came out that another individual who was a bike rider and a member, had been a member of the group Time's Up, had been spied on. An investigation opened in relationship to a terrorism attack in Times Square in 2008. And the executive director of Time's Up, they opened an investigation on him. Now, he's never been arrested, never done anything wrong, but we feel that it has a chilling effect on these activist groups.
So why did it, was there any information that ultimately ever came out as to why the police and the authorities were so interested in disrupting and shutting down a group of folks who were riding their bicycles?
Well, and that's actually the interesting question, because recently in the New York Times there have been a couple of articles about some of these bicyclists who had been spied on. Basically, the writers saying there was no evidence that they had done anything wrong. And what happened in New York City was we have Citibank and MasterCard sponsoring what's called Citibike, bike sharing program that started, I think, about 6 or 7 months ago. And the bicycles say Citibike on them. They're in the color, the corporate blue. What happened was we saw, in effect, corporate entities kind of taking over what these activists had been fighting for, more bicycles in the streets. But when do-it-yourself sort of, you know, grassroots activists tried to lobby for changes on a grassroots level, they were arrested, they were tracked, they were treated as terrorists for no reason. So we find it an interesting contrast that now the streets are filled with corporate emblazoned bicycles. And now, as a result of that spying and all, there were lawsuits by the police trying to get information about the activists. Nothing came of it. But they did enforce stricter laws where you can only ride in groups of, I think it's 20 or maybe 50 at a time. So it did have a dampening effect on that.
Now, that was one very, I think, poignant example that you pointed out at the very beginning of your book. But are there other instances across the country where the authorities have engaged in spying or attempted to disrupt citizen activists and protests?
Almost definitely. I mean, your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the fact that animal rights and environmental activists were labeled in 2005 as eco-terrorists or the top domestic terrorism threat. And for decades, public relations firm in D.C. actually came up with that term, eco-terrorism, and has been portraying these activists who, by the way, have made broad inroads in really raising consciousness about treatment of animal rights and our imperiled environment. I think in many reasons, because they've been successful, they've become a target of the government. But they've been infiltrated. People, young activists, have been intimidated by long prison sentences into turning evidence against, you know, friends and colleagues. And we see that happening a lot during the Republican and Democrat national conventions every 4 years, but it's happening all the time. And a number of films and books have been written about it, but it's a problem because they've also crafted the animal enterprise terrorism law, which is very vaguely written, but it has the effect of making people question, hey, if I go to a protest outside a puppy mill, am I going to be charged with terrorism? And I think that's a disturbing trend, especially since the events of 9/11, to cast citizen activism as acts of potential terrorism.
That's interesting that you mention 9/11 as a trigger point for some of this. I understand, though, and one of the things you highlighted was that government surveillance of citizens has sort of ebbed and flowed throughout our country's history. Can you give us maybe a little bit of a background as to how we got to the point where we are today?
Definitely throughout history, and I think during times when the country is perceived as being at some kind of risk, you see a crackdown by the government, and it should be noted there is no national security exception to the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable government searches and seizures. Nevertheless, we see very patriotic rhetorism heightened. And I think especially, you know, we saw that during the Cold War, right after 9/11, we saw really by the government and by even by individuals across the country kind of watch what you say mentality. And a lot of the protections you referenced, we had protections put in place in the early 70s after the counterintelligence programs of the FBI became public that put restrictions on when the FBI could open an investigation against U.S. citizens. Protections say that, you know, criminal activity was needed or suspicion that criminal activity was about to take place. You had to be able to articulate specific facts. Now, and after 9/11 especially, we've seen those, they're the Attorney General guidelines, we've seen those loosened and almost disappeared. Right now, I think an FBI agent needs to merely have a good faith belief that something is worth investigating. And that leaves too much discretion up to individual agents and makes it easier to really pick activists because they're visible, they're outspoken, often successful in their work, and they become the front line of who these agencies often investigate.
That's very interesting how much more discretion seems to have shifted into the hands of law enforcement with a much sort of less right or less ability of people to challenge that. I understand, though, there have been some lawsuits that have challenged that. But before we get into that, let me remind our audience that you're listening to Jaws of Justice. I'm Robin Martinez, a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And with me today is Heidi Boghossian, who is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, joining us via telephone from New York. And we're discussing her book, Spying on Democracy: Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. So let's jump back, Heidi, to this idea of challenges. Have there been some challenges recently to all of the increase in spying and surveillance and efforts by our government to crack down on dissent and protests?
There were several class action lawsuits brought in the last several years by organizations such as the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Many of those were brought when revelations surfaced under the George W. Bush administration that the government was engaging in a warrantless wiretapping program. Now, the problem was the administration gave blanket immunity to the telecommunications companies from such lawsuits. So most of those were dismissed, even though lawyers, for example, were saying, we represent people in Guantanamo or around the globe. We suspect that because of the nature of the lawsuit, you know, the lawsuits being brought against them, that the government has an interest in listening in on our conversations. But they couldn't prove it. But what they did claim, and what is still true, is that that has a chilling effect, again, on how attorneys communicate, not only with their clients on the telephone or on email, but with members of the press when talking about their cases, if they think they're being monitored. So when Edward Snowden came forth in the last few months, and we now have much more concrete evidence of the scope of these programs, the Electronic Frontier filed a new class action lawsuit. The National Lawyers Guild is a plaintiff in the case, saying that now we have more evidence. We're bringing these cases back because you really are impacting the way we conduct our work. And that, of course, ripples out into how justice is administered in this country. If you suspect that your conversations are not covered by the attorney-client privilege anymore, it really impacts the kind of defense that an attorney can mount. It may make attorneys fearful of bringing these cases in the first place, which would have an enormously detrimental impact on the justice system.
Are you seeing a little bit of maybe growing skepticism on the part of judges towards claims that are being made by the government, given all of these revelations?
During the last decade, when some of these lawsuits were brought, and it wasn't just against the phone companies, it was also on cases of civil disobedience, we would see many judges toe the party line, you know, they've broken the law and that they should be punished. But we had many brave judges also who, especially during the Occupy movement, would say, you know what, civil disobedience is a long revered tradition in this country. In fact, the judge in a class action in Occupy with when 700 protesters were mass arrested without probable cause by the police called them troublemakers, the protesters, who bring us to our senses, and had wonderful things basically to say about what the occupiers had done. So I think that, and even FISA judges recently have said that they do not believe the way the government's gone before the FISA court has been lawful. It's time to revise it. It's been improper. And so I think, yes, we are seeing judges change their tune and are emboldened really to stand up more and more and say things have not been done correctly.
Well, that's good to hear. It sounds like maybe we may have reached a little bit of a tipping point then, and there may be some momentum to push back.
I think so.
One of the things that really struck me in reading your book, beyond the notion of government surveillance of us, there's also been a huge expansion of corporate spying on Americans. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Huge is really underestimating it. I think it's integral to how surveillance is conducted. Approximately 70% of U.S. intelligence is performed through private sector contracts. What happened after the Cold War is that we saw a reduction in military contracts. And so computer and electronics companies expanded into new markets with equipment that was originally designed for military use. Even Texas Instruments, which was known for calculators and office equipment, started selling surveillance systems to the government. And as listeners know, we have drones soon to be entering domestic skies thanks to aggressive lobbyists and a lot of money dedicated into refining drones, making them smaller. We have biometric identification programs, networking technology, and radio frequency ID chips. All of these things that once were for military applications are now watching over all of. And I think there's a really snug alignment between the corporate sector and the government in how really they justify the need to develop more and more sophisticated equipment to meet what they call a growing terrorist threat assessment. So the government funnels billions of dollars into that and is reliant on corporations to conduct its analysis. We saw Ed Snowden was an analyst for Booz Allen Hamilton, and we have thousands, you know, of those analysts poking into our business. And luckily, Snowden was for many of us a hero, but a lot of our data is in the hands of others who may, for example, want to tamper with it. And we don't have any oversight. We don't know what's happening in that respect. And a lot of our legislators don't either.
That's actually rather frightening when you think about it. Now, One of the things I thought was pretty evident was a lot of these larger corporations that provide these services, I mean, clearly have an economic interest in doing so. It sounds like there are literally billions of dollars worth of government contracts that are flowing their way. But does the corporate sector have sort of its own independent reasons beyond just merely being on the government dole to engage in spying on Americans?
Most definitely. And we've seen this going back years. Some people may remember the Nestle boycott where a public relations firm consulted on, and they were spying on activists back then. They want to silence people who criticize corporate policies. As people know, corporations have played an increasingly big part in our daily lives, so that when you have a school mom, for example, preaching to her neighbors or to the people at school that, like, the drinking water is bad or that a local company is polluting or doing something wrong, just like Karen Silkwood, those people are silenced by corporations, and so it's in the corporate interest to find out who they are and, you know, find ways to intimidate them and really cut off grassroots advocacy.
You know, it's interesting that you mention that. Here in the Midwest, I recently ran across a group of kids who were involved in an organization called the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. These were a group of kids that were taking direct action to protest pipeline construction throughout Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, in some of the Great Plains states. And they had an incident down in Oklahoma where one of their training camps was actually infiltrated by the local law enforcement authorities, who it turns out were actually submitting their reports directly to TransCanada, the company that was involved in constructing those pipelines. Is that atypical, or are you seeing more and more of a almost direct law enforcement support of corporate interests that's occurring?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security created what are called fusion centers, and I think there are about 80 across the country. Fusion centers were designed to coordinate various levels of law enforcement sharing of intelligence, but they also work very closely with business, so that corporations are getting intelligence information on individuals in a way that I think would shock many people if they really knew about it. Another problem is that the information is often inaccurate, and we have no way of knowing if they've been monitoring certain individuals, what information then translates into those reports that you mentioned that go directly to a corporation. The government accounting office, the general accounting office, I think, has said there's such rates of inaccuracy, but there's no way of knowing it, and there's no way to correct it. But definitely, very close coordination between the government and corporations.
Now, you just mentioned the fusion centers. What exactly are those, and how did those come about?
They came about after the events of 9/11. I believe it was in response to the 9/11 Commission report, which was highly critical of the way intelligence is gathered and shared across the country. It's interesting because about a month ago, two of the chairpersons of the 9/11 Commission had an excellent op-ed piece in the New York Times that basically said the bureaucracy is still there, even though we've created new mechanisms such as fusion centers. There, I guess, basically there's a center or an office. They have several on the West Coast. They're in New York. They're all around where, you know, computers and analysts gather information and, again, work in partnership with local law enforcement, federal law enforcement, and then corporate partners in analyzing, gathering, storing, and collecting data. And one of the big threats, I think, is that when you store data for any period of time, years, it makes it, in my opinion, more vulnerable for abuse in terms of altering it or saying, you know, oh, you did something 5 years ago that now has come into government disfavor, and maybe that's a crime. So these are things I think people need to think about when they look at how metadata is stored, and when people say, I'm not doing anything wrong, I have nothing to worry about. Well, it may be used for improper reasons, and we don't also have any indication that this kind of gathering of data is making us any safer.
So there's been literally no effort to try to connect the dots to see whether or not what's being done is even effective?
Well, I think, again, we've built such an enormous apparatus that really sustains itself in terms of DHS and other government funding being given out to local entities such as fusion centers or local police departments, that it behooves those local entities to say, oh, you know, there are protesters here and there are anarchists who may be violent and they could have destructive tendencies that we need to watch for. So they'll keep sharing that information. But yes, I think the problem is they have issued reports even admitting that animal rights and environmental activists do not have a violent agenda, but they say, well, they might. And that seems to be a thread. I would even say that it borders on preemptive policing or predictive policing, which seems to be a shift we've seen heightened in the last decade.
So that almost gets into the notion of the very Orwellian notion of thought crimes, then, perhaps.
Exactly.
Well, this has been really fascinating, Heidi. I truly appreciate the insight that you've given us. This is such an incredibly important subject that is of interest, I think, to all of us, given our participation in both media and the various activists or organizations that many of us tend to be involved in. Again, this is Robin Martinez with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. We've been talking here on the program Jaws of Justice with Heidi Boghossian. Heidi is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, and she's authored a very important book that is definitely worth your time and effort to read, called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Heidi, I want to thank you very much for being here with us today. And
thank you so much.
And appreciate your time and effort.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's alright, that's okay, cause I'm gonna
make
my world
that's your place.
Don't
keep that smile on my face.
Yeah, I'm gonna teach my...
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. To find a link to audio of today's show, our calendar of events, and more, check out Jaws of Justice Radio on Facebook. To contact us, send an email to JawsOfJusticeRadio@yahoo.com. And to find out about future shows, check us out on KKFI's website, kkfi.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We thank our engineers, Joe Henderson and Mike Murphy, hosts of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then, round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale. Today's outro theme music is Better Man, from the Playing for Change Songs Around the World CD.
I'm gonna get back up, it'll be alright, it'll be okay. Man.
Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Go teach that smile on my face. Go teach myself how to understand. Go make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Recently, Senator Leahy held a special session to talk about the ramifications of this eternal war on drugs. Speaking at that event, this is Senator Rand Paul.
If I told you that one out of three African American males is forbidden by law from voting, you might think I was talking about Jim Crow 50 years ago. Yet today, a third of African-American males are still prevented from voting because of the war on drugs. The war on drugs has disproportionately affected young black males. The ACLU reports that blacks are 4 to 5 times more likely to be convicted for drug possession, although surveys indicate that blacks and whites use drugs at about the same similar rate. The majority of illegal drug users and dealers nationwide are white, but 3/4 of the people in prison for drug offenses are African American or Latino. Why are arrest rates so lopsided? Because it's frankly easier to go into the urban areas and make arrests than it is to go into suburban areas. Arrest statistics matter when applying for federal grants. Doesn't take much imagination to understand that it's easier to round up, arrest, and convict poor kids than it is to convict rich kids. The San Jose Mercury News reviewed 700,000 criminal cases that were matched by crime and criminal history of the defendant. The analysis revealed that similarly situated whites were far more successful than African Americans and Latinos in the plea bargaining process. In fact, at virtually every stage of pretrial negotiation, whites are more successful than non-whites. I know a guy about my age in Kentucky who grew marijuana plants in his apartment closet in college. 30 years later, he still can't vote, can't own a gun, and when he looks for work, he must check the box. The box that basically says, I'm a convicted felon, and I guess I'll always be one. He hasn't been arrested or convicted for 30 years, but he can't vote. He doesn't have his Second Amendment rights, and getting a job is nearly impossible for him. Today I'm here to ask you to create a safety valve for all federal mandatory minimums. Mandatory sentencing automatically imposes a minimum number of years in prison for specific crimes, usually related to drugs. By design, mandatory sentencing laws take discretion away from judges so as to impose often harsh sentences regardless of circumstances. Since mandatory sentencing began, Americans' prison population has exploded, quadrupled, 2.4 million people in jail. America now jails a higher percentage of citizens than any other country in the world at a staggering cost of $80 billion a year.
We'll have part two on tomorrow's report. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Support for KKFI provided by Door-to-Door Organics, partnering with farmers to bring fresh, organic, and natural groceries to your doorstep. You can shop online for fruits, vegetables, breads, meats, snacks, eggs, pasta, cheese, dressings, oil, coffee, tea, and more. Details available at kc.doortodoororganics.com.